Hello, everyone. Welcome to the first Pony Sync call of 2019. This is January 8th. We're here with Gordon, Sylvan, Paul, and Theo. Let's get started looking at RFCs. RFC pull request 135 for dealing with the modulo operator. Somebody helpfully commented, 11 days ago, that adding the partial equivalent and also the unsafe equivalent should be included, and Matthias updated to include those.
Okay.
Other than that, this has been approved by a lot of folks. Nobody's raised any objections. So unless anyone has objections to the recent updates with the partial and unsafe versions of the operator, I think we should go ahead and merge it.
No objections. This is good.
Okay. Anyone else? All right. I'm going to merge. All right, let's take a look and see if there are anybody else have any other RFCs they want to discuss?
I do think 137 is interesting. I don't think we need to necessarily go through it, but I do think it's an interesting thing to talk about.
Yeah. Let's see. Yeah. There's been some recent comments since my last look at it. I guess those are, they're mainly questions for the RFC author, but there's one that seems to be a question for me. Okay, yeah. Okay, so I guess the suggestion would be keep adding like dot pack with just sort of like and match on it within the dot pack function instead of declaring the type statically there. I think you could include both, which I think is what this person's saying. I don't see any problem with that.
With Steak Knife's proposal.
Yeah, I mean, I think the proposal is like include both. In my example, I gave like struct pack dot i32, and then you give the first i32 argument, and then dot f64 you give the f64 argument, and so on.
Right.
And then this and Big Knife saying, could you just say dot pack each time, and then have it match to find out what you gave it, which I think it's fine, although it does create some extra, like if you had an integer literal, for example, in there. If you had an integer literal, they wouldn't know if it was I32 or F64 without explicitly declaring that. So makes sense. Probably both.
I guess from a type system point of view, what interested me about this was that it really seems to beg for type inference of generic methods, where if you can imagine that struct pack had an apply that returned itself,
right?
You could say struct pack parens the first thing, parens the second thing, parens the third thing, parens the fourth thing, and get the correct instantiation based on the generic over what it could be, and it would return itself, so you could just keep calling essentially apply as you go.
What would happen if you have a U32 or U16
as an argument?
Inference.
So I think
you're getting an error.
You should get an error, right? You shouldn't be able to pack a union type, right? Because it only operates over a certain subset of stuff. Particularly, this one says I32 F64 string or array. I think that.
So you'd still have to end up implementing both the specialized implementation as well as the implementation where you have to match.
I think if we had it over if this was over a type variable that was a union type of those things and enforced that it had a constructor such that you couldn't pass a union type, we would make sure that we only got something that was one of those concrete things.
That works. It's just that I think maybe steak knife suggestion was that, like, you know, you'd be able to work with, like let's say you didn't know, like, for example, you got it from like a command line argument or something that could have been multiple different options or something like that. I don't have a concrete example, but yeah, you just force the match to be on the outside. And what's actually weird about that is that you, how would you write that code in an elegant way? Like, let's say that you were given a reference of union type I32 union F64. You'd have to like write a match statement to pull it out into one or the other, and then put like the struct pack parens within that match statement. But the code in each side of the match statement would look identical.
Wow, that's pretty funny.
This is sort of, I guess it points to, in my opinion, like why the generic, you know, implementing it as generic type parameter inference is a little bit awkward, because it requires you to, if you use type parameter, right, then you have to use if type inside, which is a different mechanism from match.
Yeah.
And if you had those, you know, unified, right, to where you, your implementation of struct pack apply, was agnostic of, like the code is agnostic of whether the type is fully concrete at the time or not. But if it is fully concrete, the compiler knows how to take advantage of that. Like when it sees the match, for example, like you could treat match as if it were if type implicitly. But I don't know. To me, this ideally, what I'd like to do is just be able to mark that a parameter in my method can be specialized, like automatically by the compiler, and I don't have to go to the bother of adding a type parameter for it and giving the same constraint moving the constraint over to the type parameter. Like I would just tell it to use the constraint of the use the type of the parameter as the constraint of the implicit type parameter, and just sort of like the compiler would automatically know how to do that, and then also propagate that down through any runtime type matching to see if it can make those compile time type matches.
And also avoid the boxing, right?
Right.
That's very interesting.
But it would still allow boxing in cases like where, you know, the caller didn't specialize, then you can still allow the caller to happen that way.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Because essentially it is I see what you mean. I hope I see what you mean. It is a generic formal parameter, but in some sense, it's a generic formal parameter that's inferred by the compiler.
Right. So you could think of it like an annotation, like we have the annotation syntax with the slash, and then so you could put an annotation on the parameter that says, hey, specialize this thing as a performance optimization or whatever.
Right.
And then the compiler would specialize it when possible by treating it as a formal type parameter implicitly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's very interesting. In some sense, this is a pretty crappy sense, I apologize, but in some sense we're doing this already with box functions, where we actually generate three versions of the function depending on the reference capability of the receiver at the call site.
Right.
We can generate up to three versions, I should say. We don't actually always generate all of them.
Only reachable ones.
Yeah. And in some sense, what you're describing is at least as far as I can tell, a really nice extension of that that says this applies to all the arguments. If there is a specialization that would matter, and in some sense, the compiler could figure out if specialization mattered. If you pattern matched on type, then specialization mattered. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So you're talking about avoiding the annotation entirely and trying to have the compiler determine via some heuristic whether specialization would be helpful to you, or are you talking about still including the annotation?
Determine if specialization would be helpful and not needing the annotation. Because in some sense, once we have that reachability, we know there is more information we have about that reachability, is that we know the types of the arguments more specifically, right? Because of reachability analysis.
Right, and reachability, starts at actor main and reaches down through reaches down through the call sites from the root, right?
Right. So it automatically does dead code elimination. So we really are getting just the invocations that matter. This is quite, sorry, I hope I'm not boring folks. I think this is really quite an interesting idea, Joe.
We discussed something similar to this kind of at my prompting. I don't know if it was the last sync because it was so long ago, but a recent sync call. And I was talking about sort of like global specialization and like when that could actually be to performance detriments, like things with like the L4 cache, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I agree. I was going to tie it into that conversation because I think that if this is insane, but if we take that global specialization thing and we say, okay, what if we treat all type information about arguments as constraints, specializable constraints, which is in some sense more like an ML type language, we could provide the same heuristic. Well, not the same, but a similar heuristic to inlining to this.
Right. I don't know that much about inlining personally, but yeah, there's some heuristic you can apply, right?
Yeah, mostly it's just about code size. It just says, I mean, inlining heuristics are actually dreadfully simple, and it says, well, how big is it? Well, it's this many bytes. Well, that's kind of big. I guess I won't inline it. That's pretty reasonably sized, I guess I'll go for it. And of course, you run into problems of over-inlining and under-inlining, but roughly speaking, it works pretty well. And this would basically say, here's the collection of specialization candidates. If I have two of them, probably I should specialize, right? If I have 46 of them, I probably shouldn't.
Right.
And
they were all used, like, unless there's only like, oh, you're talking about call sites. Okay, never mind. Forget it.
Exactly. Call sites that have, that would result in different code gen.
Right, right. Unique signatures.
Yeah.
Okay.
And part of the reason I think that's so interesting is the thing that you just said earlier about if type and match being different.
When they don't need to be.
They don't need to be. Right. Right. Under this kind of specialization, they wouldn't be different. Now, I think there is some danger, much as there is with inlining, of, and maybe this comes back to your annotation thing, of, okay, now the programmer doesn't really know how efficient the code compilation is.
Right. Right, which, in which case you could use an annotation to try to enforce something a particular way you wanted.
Right.
In cases where it is performance critical.
Yeah. And I wonder, actually, I kind of wonder if it would be feasible with such a language design to eliminate most, if not all, function level generic formal parameters and turn them into union types.
You normally keep like the class level formal parameters, like the type level one.
Yeah. That's pretty interesting. Yeah.
I wonder about that. So I mentioned I've been using Crystal a little bit, which is where I kind of got this idea from, because this is how they do it, right?
Right.
They don't have, I'm trying to think about this. Like, and how this relates, like they only have type parameters on types, like array, for example, things like that, collections usually, but they do have a syntax for individual functions where they say something like for all x, to specify that like that I'm not going to be specific about this type,
okay.
So I'm wondering if there's something there that forces us to need that, just because they needed it. But also I noticed that they don't allow you to be like you can't specify there's a few like really general types, bottom types, I guess, that their type system can't handle for whatever reason, and they don't allow you to use those as parameter types, and maybe that's why they need that extra syntax.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. Sorry, Paul was just giving me a funny look here in the office, so I'll try and clarify.
How did you remove type parameters and methods?
Just generic formal parameters. Because if you said, okay, here's a generic formal parameter T, such that we have some X of type T.
Yeah.
Now you could say, if there's no constraint over that, that is an X of type any.
Yeah, but what if you want to return it?
And now you have the binding problem.
Yeah, right. Really generics when you appears multiple times.
So it handles it for, yeah, you're right. Because it handles it for the compilation issue, and you absolutely could go down and find the specific size and compile the most efficient representation, and you would lose it on the way out.
Yeah.
Unless you had some way of saying, oh, it's the type of X, at which point, hey, look, it's called generics, it works pretty well.
Yeah. Right.
But also, on the specialization thing, you don't have to do it all or nothing. You can, like, build the lattice of all the call site signatures.
Right.
And pick a few.
Yes. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And that would be a nice way to do it, where you could say, hey, this is invoked a lot, or this appears to be a hot path, or all these kinds of heuristics.
Yeah.
So you couldn't get rid of all uses of generic methods, but you could get rid of some uses of generic methods. That's quite interesting.
Yeah.
But not binding.
Yeah. So,
I wonder if, you know, is there some syntax we'd want to add where, no, I guess that would be, never mind. Forget I said anything.
That's how I feel all the time. Okay, I think it's interesting that we have yet another call where we're talking about roughly the same sort of mechanism here. I think that means we're probably really onto something.
Yeah, or at least that I've been thinking a lot about it.
that counts, right? That's pretty interesting. Okay.
So I'll probably mull that over a bit more. That's something that probably would need an RFC, or I don't know if it's not really a language change, but it might. There might be some kind of like thing. Like I guess the annotation is a language change, right? So
I think so. I think it's more an RFC. It's not a language change. You're right, but I think it's enough about the way that we would write Pony code that I think it's probably worth it.
Yeah. So I'll mull it over a bit more and then try to put out an RFC about that so we can discuss it a little more
Sounds good.
Concretely. Are there any other RFCs you wanted to discuss? I guess I'll just call out that RFC pull request 134 by Arip has been he's been putting together a work in progress pull request on the Pony C repo just to get feedback and stuff. So that's
available
to look.
Okay, that's excellent. I'll have a look at that. Thanks for pointing that out. I didn't realize that there was a branch for that. That's exciting. Paul had a question about the 137 though.
Has there been talk about how we would do unpack yet?
Not that I'm aware of. No, we haven't talked a lot about it.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about how we could do it, but. I don't see without like periodic generics or stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, yeah, it seems like it would be it would have to be, you know, without variadic stuff, like we've got to have like a sequence of calls, one for each thing you want to unpack. And so I would imagine just a bunch of, like a sequence of unpack calls, each one being partial.
Ouch.
Yeah,
be hard to do proper error handling on that.
You do struct unpack dot R32 with like no arguments.
But in terms of how you're filling it in, it would be nice to say something like, if we believe we know what the format is statically, it would be nice to say unpack and a sequence of types and get back a tuple that is those sequence of types.
Yeah, that would be great, but that's where I say you probably need periodics.
Yeah, because you just don't have a sequence of types that you can express.
Yeah, either that or the old fallback of like struct unpack 4, struct unpack 5, struct unpack 6.
Right, exactly. Which, you know, Erlang still exists. I mean that in a positive way about Erlang, right? It's not negative. Yeah, that's interesting. Because variadic type arguments is something we have quite successfully avoided and seems worth pursuing the avoidance of.
Does any language have it other than C++? Not a lot of people have generics anyway.
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know.
It's probably a sign.
That's maybe worth looking into, but okay. So Yeah, I don't have any specific ideas about unpacking. But it's worth thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, the variadic type arguments would need, or type parameters would need, like, special syntax, I think, to use them. And again, yeah, you'd need to have a syntax that, like...
they're gruesome, because all they do is end up getting us tuples. And it feels like if we were going to go down that route, what we'd want is something more like compile time reflection, so that you could provide it something to unpack into, and it would know what the target was, and you could do compile time reflection over that type and get its fields in sequence, and then, even if it was a tuple, and then unpack to them with the correct types. And then you don't need variadic type arguments, but you do need compile time reflection, but compile time reflection seems like a fantastically more interesting thing than variadic type arguments.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, some form of, like, macro system with ability to look at and operate over types would be
right.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I think that mostly becomes compile time reflection, if that makes any sense. Runtime reflection may be also being useful, but not, but not necessarily what we need here, right? In this specific case, right. You'd say, I'm expecting to unpack something of this format, slap it into this class for me, and you would generate the right code.
Mm.
And clearly it would be partial, because all unpacking is partial, and all unpacking in the universe is partial in some sense.
I mean, the big issue with compile time reflection is backwards compatibility. If you change the language, then...
Come on, we're always okay with changing
language.
Right? That's rule number one. I think the bigger issue with compile time reflection is making sure that we don't have reflection that is not capabilities safe. Right, and that's very hard with runtime reflection. I think it's solvable with compile time reflection, but it's not something that we put a lot of time in.
Yeah.
You disagree?
I haven't thought of the capability part of reflection.
Right. I think that's the interesting bit. Yeah, I think that's the interesting bit. I think there are many horrible syntaxes we can imagine that would let us do this. And things like respecting encapsulation. What does it mean if you're trying to say you're going to respect encapsulation over that type? Maybe that's okay. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I think it would be awkward in the sense that we're not allowing, I don't think this, like, for example, in this unpack case, if we're going to do it with compile time reflection, I can't think of a nice way to do it other than making all the fields public in the type that you're unpacking to. And that doesn't seem great.
Well, unless, let's say that you had a class with fields that, and then you had a macro of some sort within it that says, okay, generate an unpack or in a pack method for this class, you know, using these fields or whatever. Then it's only, it only requires reflection over the class's own fields.
Uh-huh.
So the way you do this in Rust or Haskell is you have like a deserialized type class that you can derive automatically.
Yep.
And that derive, at least in Rust and Haskell, I'm not sure, has to be in the same module as where you define the struct.
Right.
So there you have access to everything. You have access to fields, I mean.
Yeah. It would have to be in the same module for that. Okay.
But
right.
Then,
so you use compile time reflection to say, please derive this unpack.
Trait or
right.
Interface or whatever. And then unpack would just be bound on the unpack trait or mm-hmm. It wouldn't even exist. The top level unpack.
That's interesting. And look at building out that way rather than having the code that does the compile time reflection in the struct pack code.
The problem then is that if someone defined a type, didn't derive that type class,
then you're done.
Then you're screwed.
Yeah.
So you can have like a shadow struct that has the same field and copy them over and allow.
Yeah, exactly.
I know in Rust, I don't know how Haskell does it.
Well, Haskell is not as concerned about encapsulation, so it lets you go ahead and extend types in new code. So you just go ahead and add the ability to treat it as that. Perhaps that's fine. I don't know.
But Haskell also has compile time reflection for like all types.
Yeah. Yeah. In a quite nice way, actually.
Doesn't Simon work on this?
No.
Yeah. We can talk to him about it, but. Yeah. I would put this in the category of compile time reflection, still interesting.
Yep.
All right, so, sorry, 134. I'll have a look at his examples. Thank you. Is there anything more that we should talk about for that?
Well, I'll just mention that 134 is still in a very early state. I mean, what's basically happening right now is work in progress pull request. He's opened it just because, you know, he's trying to get familiarized with the compiler. He has questions every now and then.
Yes.
I wouldn't say it's at a state where like, oh, hey, come review this complete implementation at all. Like, it's just more of a, like, there is work ongoing and it's just sort of in the early stages at the moment.
Right. Okay, great. Cool. I'm impressed that he's having a go at it. That's pretty awesome.
Do we have like concrete use cases for this? Or
for higher kind of types?
Yeah. I mean, I know there's a lot of them in general, but in the context of Pony?
Nothing more specific than the fact that they are useful in general for some stuff.
Yeah.
Nothing particular that we're going, oh gosh, if only we had higher kind of types for such, we could implement this. Unless you're aware of anything, anyone else?
I mean, I think we, my other RFC pull request 123, where we talked about use site variants, I think the final conclusion there was that like those use cases would be better served by higher kind of types.
Yeah, that's true.
I didn't really understand how you got to that conclusion.
It was a comment Sylvan made at the end there of pull request 123. I don't know that. There's a lot of detail in the comment, but yeah, maybe someone can explain further.
A lot of this stuff with extracting interfaces is actually easier to write as a higher kind of interface that the thing implements in the first place. But I don't think we should spend too much time on it. We can talk about it more.
Yeah, we'll talk about it.
Just because Paul's here, and we can talk about it. All right. Sorry for expecting.
Anyways, so I will add that we're past the halfway mark here. So if anyone has any special topics they want to bring up, feel free to do so at this time. Looking at, there was an issue marked needs discussion during sync, although I personally don't think it needs that much discussion. Issue 2969 in the Pony C repo, range.next has surprising behavior that can lead to infinite loops. Basically, the gist of this is that if your caller is not calling has next to determine whether to move forward with iteration, and it just calls next instead, then it will just keep returning infinitely because next is not, the implementation of next is not partial. It just keeps returning the final index over and over again, I think it's fairly easy to just say make it partial and the else case of that Sean pasted the code there. The else case of that should just be else error instead of else final index.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. there's always the fear that we've got this backwards, and this should be a peak and move to next, right? Or some other iterator interface. But I think while we have has next and next, I think that's a pretty reasonable result. Go ahead and say if you call next and there was no next, then whose fault was that? Error.
Yeah.
The only reason we have has next is because errors are expensive.
Yes.
Foxing is expensive.
Yeah. You don't want to call next until it returns an error because of the performance cost.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I wish I keep thinking there's probably a better way to do iterators, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I agree. value
enums.
Value enums?
Rather than like not allocated enums. Sometimes.
Oh.
Because then you have a
discriminated unions.
Yeah. What are we going
on? Yeah, so actually there's a bunch of different stuff. Having discriminated unions isn't actually, we don't need discriminated unions in order to do it, but having a more compact representation of union types that takes advantage of both NAN-boxing and discriminated unions when necessary, because a lot of the times with NAN-boxing, you don't even need the discriminated union, would definitely be a big win.
Yeah, but you have U64 or none.
Right. So the core types that cause a problem with NAND boxing are U64 and I64. Everything else you can get away with.
Yeah.
So the only discriminated union is if U64 or I64 or equivalent types, U size and I size on a 64-bit mm-hmm. platform, appear in the union type. And otherwise, you don't even need the extra byte.
Yeah.
And I agree. Doing that is very much a thing we should do. I agree. It would make
a huge
number of cases that require boxing right now simply not require boxing, and that's great.
So that means that the size of your unions changes based on what's in...
But statically, not dynamically.
Yeah, statically. Might be a mess.
It certainly can be surprising to people.
So the idea there is if we had that feature, then next would be like A or none?
Yeah. And the only time that wouldn't return a pointer size word is if A contained a 64-bit integer value. As a possible type.
Or float, right?
Possible type.
64-bit float, too, as well, right?
Actually, 64-bit floats are okay because there are enough not-a-number values that you can, hide the pointer as a not-a-number value and say, oh, that's not a number. It's probably a pointer, and mask it off.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that would be a large change for the language, but probably for the better. I'd still like a lot of iterators to have a peak when possible, just because that's a nice feature to have to not move the iterator forward. But
yeah, I was experimenting with an alternate implementation of Andy Turley's iter package, where we had a different iterator interface, and there were a bunch of iterator implementations that got simpler with a peak and a has next and a move to next, as opposed to a has next and a next.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so there's no way of consuming an iterator that gives you ISOs. Mm-hmm. Can you do that?
Well, it has to strip it out of the original the container.
Yeah, of course. But something that like empties a vec or array or whatever.
We don't currently have iterators implemented that do that, but we could certainly do that, right? But they would be specific to a type. They would need to know how to actually pop things out and return them.
Yeah, but I mean, like, an iterator over the lines of this file that should be in stream and ISO.
Yeah, I see what you mean, because you've got the file under the hood. Yep. Similarly, if you wanted to strip an array, you could do that, right?
Mm-hmm. Or if you were iterating over the lines of a file, your peak could return ISO, I think.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
Just be copying
the peak.
The problem with peak is it has to keep it in case you ask for it next, whereas next doesn't have to keep it.
Right, but okay. I thought you were saying you removed next from the
right. Interface. So that's the point that I think Paul is making, is that if you do move to peak instead of next, then you have a very distinct problem with iterators over isolated things, because you can only return them once.
And right. So if someone calls peak multiple times, then you got nothing to do then.
Yeah.
That's why I think, like, we should have iterator, which only has next, and then, like, peakable iterator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
More sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then most of any type that in the standard library that can implement peak should.
Yeah.
The problem is, for iterator adapters, we don't have a way of saying implement peakable if the source iterator also implements peakable. You would need like if type, but outside the, which I think has been talked about before.
Yeah, this is like special, like methods that don't exist if the type constraints aren't met, rather than raising an error.
Yeah,
exactly. Which,
yeah, specialized methods. Yeah.
It is actually,
it was accepted, but it has not been implemented.
Right. Yeah. And it's a thing, funnily enough, that C++ is doing more and more with the enable if v macro. Well, not macro, it's actually a template, but yeah.
The syntax of it is insane.
It is a little bit insane. I will cop to agreeing with that. And we don't have to be quite that crazy. But it does let you do some very interesting stuff.
Yeah.
But then, do you also have a way to say, because for traits, you'd also have to say, like, class C is this trait if type that. So you need your trait list to also be specializable.
Yeah. So this goes back to something that I keep bringing up, which is I kind of think we should just remove traits from the language.
Are you going to say you need type classes?
Huh? What?
I thought you were going to say we need type classes.
Well, but structural interfaces give you that, right?
Nah. Yeah. Not really.
What are we missing?
You can't.
There's no rename.
Hmm?
There isn't a rename, so you can't reuse a method to something else, but you specify it on the type rather than through a type class adapter.
Yeah, but you can't implement stuff on a type that isn't yours.
Exactly, that's what I mean. Because there isn't the rename.
What do you mean the rename?
Well, if you have some function F on your type class, but your type only gives you a G, but G would totally work as an F, it doesn't work.
But it doesn't necessarily totally work as an F.
Right, you want additional code?
Yeah, additional code. You don't have access to the private stuff, but just additional code.
Which gives you an extension method type situation. Yeah. Yep.
That's a whole different thing.
Yeah, but a very interesting thing. Yeah. But so I know I bring this up fairly regularly about removing traits. Does anyone have any new reasons why removing traits is bad? Because so far, I don't think anyone has said removing traits is all that bad. Just in case anyone has thought of anything.
I guess, can you reiterate, like, what you think what we gain by removing traits? Like, what's the goal? What's the problem being solved? I'm not remembering it right now.
Sure, yeah. So the most important thing for me is that it's not clear when a programmer should use a trait or an interface. And interfaces, the only thing that traits give you that interfaces don't give you is to solve the cowboy widget problem, where two things have a draw method, but you definitely don't want one when you expected the other.
Right.
That's real, don't get me wrong. But I'm not sure that that's worth having the extra complexity of having a trait versus an interface. And there's additional stuff, like Paul was just saying, of, oh gosh, you need to have, for your trait list, you need to have an if type set over your trait list. You're only that trait if you happened to have the things that did right to implement that trait, which you might not have. They might have disappeared because of one of your generic parameters isn't right. Whereas with interfaces, that's not a problem. You just happen to be one of those, or you don't happen to be one of those. So that I'm not sure what we gain by leaving trait in, and then it's programmer confusion about what to use.
Yeah. So are you saying that we'd also remove explicit interface is statements?
No, or go ahead and leave that in because it lets you pick up default implementations.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. But then I guess the problem that Paul raised is still there. It's just that you couldn't explicitly, you know, say that I am this interface if that depended on specializable methods. And I guess there's no way for you to sort of like statically verify, like say it's a library, right? And let's say my library exposes an iterator and I want to make sure that that's there. I don't know if that's a real problem or not, but it's like as a programmer, can I be sure that this implements the interface correctly?
Right.
Especially for code I'm packaging as a library where I'm not necessarily the call site.
Right.
Instead of putting that in just after the class name, you can just have it as not a field, but like an assertion inside the class or a top level assertion that can be inside an if type.
Well, that's interesting.
It's just
that makes sense.
Top level, type level assertion.
Yep.
Yeah, I like that.
That's very interesting.
And the thing is the existing syntax could still work, right? Because we're not depending on all existing things of like type F is X would still work because the is X can be freely moved in, you know, into the body because we're not white space dependent.
Oh, so you're saying this is backwards compatible?
Yes.
Cool. I feel like we've a little bit derailed away from issues. Is there any issues we need to cover?
Yeah. So 2969, I think unless anyone else has objections to it, I think the right solution is just to make next partial and do else error.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not sure how hard that's going to be on code. I hope not that hard, but I guess we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, is there a legitimate behavior where you want it to just keep returning?
If you do, it's okay to implement a partial with a non-partial function, right? So that's okay.
Yeah, I just wonder, is there a case where anyone's, is there a legitimate case of using range.next in a non-partial way?
Yeah, certainly an infinite generator. It's not particularly in the case of range, but for arbitrary iterators.
Well, so you could
actually
pass,
wait
like,
a minute. What's the top level? Am I just confused? Or did we need to change iterator.next, or is it just
range? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course we just change that. Okay. I can't see anything outside of that.
Okay, yeah.
We'd left iterator.next as total.
It's just, I don't know if range does it, but you might want to pass none to the second argument of range. And then it's open-ended and and never fails.
Right, but then you write a different concrete type.
Yeah.
It's not a range. A range is from here to here, and you write a different concrete type. Range. Yeah, well, but, right?
But yeah,
why introduce the overhead on that type when you can have a new type that can handle that in a very optimized way and fulfills all the same interfaces? So I think it's okay.
Yeah, range doesn't do that anyway. Just for the record.
Okay.
So I'm adding that as a comment. That was the one that I noticed marked needs discussion during sync, but I'm going to see if there's any more. The only other one is, 1330, investigate compilation to GPUs, which Sean marked as needs discussion to weigh in on the question that MPBAGOT asked. I'm not sure how to pronounce that username.
I apologize. Can you give me the issue number again?
Yeah, 1330. Person asked, I'd really like to do some work on this. I don't think I'm particularly qualified. If any tips or pointers could be given on where to start, I'd be happy to give it a go. Though I do wonder, given that most GPU-based code from a little research I've done functions by using a host program to send processing kernels to the GPU and fetching the results later, how should this behavior be written in Pony code? Or should each new actor beyond main, which can be the host, be forked as a new work item in the corresponding work group on the GPU? For example, a newly created outstream actor becomes a new work item in the existing outstream work group. Yeah, so the original, scope of this issue ticket is LLVM has experimental support of NVPTX and AMD GPU backends. Getting Pony to run on these proof of concept would be great. I'm not familiar with this at all, so I have nothing to say on this because I've never looked into GPU compilation, but if anybody has anything
to say. So I think this is a super interesting thing, and it ties into SPMD processing in general, single program multiple data processing in general. It's not really just specific to GPUs. You can also imagine that this is a nice thing to think about in terms of vectorization. It's a nice thing to think about in terms of other interesting custom hardware for computation. And I think this is a great thing for MPBAGO, or MPBAGO, sorry. My apologies, lovely person. I'm not pronouncing that right. To look into. I think the way that he's talking about it, I said they are talking about it right now, is to use an OpenCL kernel or a CUDA kernel, download that on the GPU and run it. And that's an absolutely perfectly good way to do it. But that's a little bit different from what I think the issue was about, which is about what can you actually compile Pony code to target the GPU directly. And in that case, I think there are several different levels of this, and probably a better place to start would be to talk about introducing an annotation that says this thing is targeting the GPU. And at that point,
an annotation at what level?
I suspect the right level is actually not at an actor level, but at a function level. So it's because GPUs are strangely, they're not great at things like scheduling and things like that, right? So having a chunk of code at the function level that was compiled targeting the GPU, and we had a chunk of code that would then, you would say, okay, instantiate that function on the GPU, and now you can call it and pass data to it. And it eventually fills up, you know, a texture buffer or whatever it is you're gonna deal with in order to get data back out if it's not the screen. It's probably closer to the model that talks about targeting Pony code at GPUs, but in some sense, it's really arbitrary non-CPU computation. Well, no, because I'm even wrong about that, because there's also the issue of vectorization of saying, oh, what do we do if we want to say we have a very large vector that we want to operate as parallel as possible over for a given target, which could even be, you know, AVX 512 on an Intel CPU.
So just to make sure, I'm trying to take notes on what you're saying for the comment. You're saying something akin to introduce annotation at the function level to specify that the function is targeting the GPU, and then the parameters go into a texture buffer. Is that right?
So when you're dealing with the GPU, yeah, you've only got a few different ways to communicate stuff, and mostly it has to do with render targets, which texture buffers can also be used as render targets. So my apologies, my knowledge of GPUs is entirely from graphics, and I know they're very rarely used for graphics nowadays, so I'm probably using the wrong terms. But the sense of you set up certain buffers on the card that then your shaders are going to reference during computation, and they're going to essentially render to your output texture buffer, which may or may not be the screen, right? You might be reading it back. And then really all that is a big 2D matrix that you can do computation over. So in some sense, saying, oh, this is also CPU vectorization is a really interesting thing to look at. I mean, SPMD is a big and interesting space. There's probably a PhD in this, but I think it's great that this person is interested and a great thing to start poking at.
Okay, I have taken some general comments about that, and I've added that as a comment. If there's anything you want to add or correct about what I just typed, feel free to do so.
Just reading it really quick now. I think that sounds great.
Okay. All right, so that brings us to the end of the hour. Any other quick comments or thoughts people want to share before we adjourn? All right, well, thanks everyone.